So the idea isn't for me to talk at you too much. I'm just going to remind you of how the group is organized and specify the scope of today's topic of conversation. And then we have the whole hour for open discussion. So let me say a few things. We're going to follow the standard SNOMES guidelines. I think everyone here is familiar with these. We have a small group, so I would say we should just go ahead and I guess we should do the hand raising. I'll moderate, so please raise your hand when you have comments. The scope of this group is to cover all aspects of how the HEP community communicates and engages with the government, which includes all levels of government in principle, although historically our community has mostly been focused on engaging the US federal government and specifically Congress for the purpose of advocating for our field within the federal budget process. So this extends to community engagements with the funding agencies, as well as with staff members within specific offices, executive branch offices, like the Office of Management and Budget. So since the previous SNOMES, community efforts in this arena really have been focused on this annual DC trip, which is led through out of Fermilab, Slack, and the US LHC users groups, with some level of input from DPF. We've identified four broad topics that we're facilitating conversations on. This was meant to be a organizational tool leading up to the CPM, and this isn't to say that these are the only questions we want to consider. We definitely want the community to provide input, and if there are other things we haven't thought of, we welcome feedback. So topic one is engagement with Congress for the purpose of advocating for HEP funding. So this is the realm of what we've been doing, the annual DC trip and logistics and all that, and possibly expanding that to include additional advocacy throughout the year or for more of the community. Topic two is the idea of engaging with Congress on different topics that aren't related to the budget but impact the HEP community. So for example, there are areas of STEM education legislation and legislation that affects our foreign national colleagues. Topic three is, this error is not correct. Sorry about that. This is expanding our engagement to target additional government entities that aren't the US federal Congress. So more directly engaging with other executive branch entities or state and local governments, for example. And then topic four is today's meeting, which is all aspects of advocacy training and education. So this is asking ourselves, how well educated is the HEP community about the advocacy that we have been doing? And the advocacy that we've been doing as a community has been going on for a long time. How can we improve awareness within the community about these efforts? And then as a separate topic, how can we improve the training that our community members are given to advocate both as part of the HEP-wide community and, if appropriate, as standalone advocacy training so that they can more effectively engage their elected representatives. So the strategy that we've identified for discussing these topics is to have a variety of public meetings where we focus on one of these broad topics. And the progression that we've identified is to start with a community chat like we're doing today, which has very loose structure. And the idea is to just gather input and try to identify some more specific questions so that when we have a town hall, we can invite experts to hear on specific topics and start to understand what where this working group should dig into more specifics. And then the current idea is that this would evolve into more of a workshop format where folks would come to these conversations. Maybe we would break out and drill down on specific questions and identify ideas or start drafting texts that might end up in the ultimate Snowmass paper. This is to be fleshed out, but we're going to try this 2 weeks from today on the topic of the existing congressional advocacy framework and how we can improve it. So that leading up to the CPM, we'll have tried out a few different strategies and hopefully have an idea of what works best. I think you all know this, so I'll skip over it. Luis is working on live minutes that you're welcome to view. Okay, so today's topic of conversation is training and education, and I have two sides of prompts, but I will welcome any and all feedback starting now. So on the topic of training the community to advocate for our field, I think it would be constructive for us to understand who in this meeting has participated in the existing HEP advocacy efforts in the past. I know that I and Luis have. Maybe if...
I have.
I have not within the context of HEP, but I have in the context of, like, I don't know, science overall, like through the AAAS case workshop.
And what sort of experience was that?
Yeah, so that was, sorry. So the AAAS does an annual workshop that's like a couple days long where they train you. It's like, it's basically for like STEM grad students. And they train you for like a day or two on how to do advocacy and how the federal government is involved in budgeting and like what you're advocating for basically when you advocate more generally for research funding. And then we did a Hill visit and talked to legislators' offices about our specific research and which agencies fund it and why those agencies deserve either maintained or increased funding.
Do you go, so this is interesting to me because I only have experience in the effort that we do as a community. Do you go into offices with a specific budgetary request or is it just?
So it's funny, we actually went, I'm like pretty sure we went the same week you guys did or maybe like the following week or something. Cause I had some friends who were doing the AGP visit, but anyway, the answer is yes. It's a little tricky because, so the workshop was organized by the AAAS, but the Hill visits, were like, they weren't really organized by the AAAS. They were just kind of like, here's a day, but they were organized by the university that you came from. So like, I'm a student at UC Berkeley and what we did was the University of California as a whole had targets for budgetary funding of the DOE, the NSF, and the NIH. And they had specific numbers that they came up with. And we just kind of said those numbers that the University of California had worked on.
Interesting. And how many folks were part of the Hill Day and how many offices?
Yeah, it was about like 200, I think, 200 people.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a big program. So, because it's the AAAS, obviously. So it's like any science discipline. It's mostly grad students, but there's like a handful of senior undergrads that go. You target the legislators who like you have connections to, So like we mostly met with only California legislators, but then like I'm from New Jersey originally, and so I also met with one or two people from the New Jersey delegation. But like if you have like 200 people doing this, then obviously everyone's from around the country, so people end up doing a pretty diverse swath of districts. I can just I'll drop a link in the chat about this workshop.
Great. I think that one of the gaps in our structural knowledge is about how other communities engage in this advocacy. We have some level of feedback from the funding agencies and from congressional offices themselves that we as a community are relatively well organized in our efforts. And I am prone to believe that, but I also haven't experienced any other efforts. So it's a little difficult to tell from the inside. So external experience is a asset for these conversations. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, no worries. I will just mention that this workshop I went to was in 2019, and then about a month after that I went to the APS April meeting and I met Fernanda, and she was giving like a presentation about like the HEP Hill Day. And I'll just mention that like what she was talking about was really quite similar to like our experience in terms of like the advice she was giving for people to do advocacy and kind of the experience of visiting with legislators and all of that. So like, yeah, I mean, it seems like the strategy that we took and the strategy that the HEP Hill visit takes is very similar. Except of course, I know you guys try to do like all 435 offices and we definitely didn't do that. But I think generally a lot of the strategy is very similar.
So I guess trying to distinguish the, I have lots of opinions about the tactics that we have for accomplishing our goal of meeting with every office, but that I think falls more into the realm of the logistics of how we execute the trip. More related to today's conversation is how we draw from the community to identify folks to participate in the advocacy in the first place. How did you come to participate in the AAAS advocacy effort?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I'm gonna give you two answers, because there's how did I personally do it, and then kind of just how people in AAAS generally do it. So the general AAAS, I don't know, solicitation for participation is that the universities chooses up to 4 students to participate. So like every university does it differently, but I think generally like AAAS emails the government relations office at like all the major universities around the country and just says, hey, this workshop's coming up, send us your students. But due to like attendance restraints, they only can accept up to like 4 students per university. It's also, by the way, I'll just mention, it's not free, but there's like registration, and obviously there's like hotel and stuff. And the universities tend to have to pay for that rather than AAAS paying for it. But anyway, I don't think that's relevant. So they just say, send us your students, up to 4 students per institution. And then each institution just kind of handles it differently. So then for me specifically, the way that I got involved was that I'm involved in our science policy student group at UC Berkeley. And so we, for the last few years, have just been, as like one of our main things that we do, is that every year we've been sending 4 students to this AAAS workshop. So that's about it. It's just a thing that we've been doing in our science policy student group for a couple of years. And so that's how I got involved. But then I guess to answer a little bit more broadly of like how we found out about it in the first place from Berkeley was just that in our science policy group, one of our members, she had a good relationship with our university's government relations office, and the government relations office, the head of it was just like, hey, there's this workshop going on, like you should go to it.
So this sounds parallel to our community experience in that you self-identified as someone who was interested in science policy and became a part of this group.
Yeah,
and then that group had the opportunity to participate in the advocacy.
Yes.
Whereas you could imagine an alternate strategy being that the advocacy group, the science policy interest group, undertakes some campaign to find the 4 best suited people in the university to participate in this. Not that, you know, that's a reasonable thing for you to do, but one of the challenges that, in my opinion, our community is facing is that too much of this existing advocacy is just who happened to be on the Fermilab UEC and then gets pulled into this orbit, and we don't do enough to reach farther out.
I mean, I think there's an important distinction there, Rob, that the UEC and the ESPA are, you know, elected representatives, right? They were elected by the users community of, you know, the younger or general Fermilab users community to have that role. So yes, it isn't reaching out to the whole area because of the logistics of doing that, but you should be careful in how we sell it, right? Like they were elected to have that role because they, you know, are elected because they have the respect of the community and are believable to be able to speak for the community. I agree, you know, especially while we've now made our efforts more broad, then this becomes a larger question because you need to pull in more than just those set of people. And yes, as we talk about taking this from being, you know, an effort that was driven by these 3 users groups, which were able to have the funding from it, to making it a community-wide effort, then it becomes a more complicated conversation. But, you know, there is a very logical reason why those people were there. And it wasn't just that they self-identified, right? They were elected as a representation of a relatively large sort of the field.
But yes. I do think Rob has a good point. I mean, the thing is that even if I I'm personally somewhat interested in it, and I'm on the UEC, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm the right person to do it. But you could imagine some sort of scheme where we try to where the UEC would try to do something like raise money for professional advocates, or you know, try to raise money for funding. Even professional advocates, advocate advisors.
So we have professional advocate advisors, and they are funded by the bucket of money that funds the UEC, because it has no its own money. So what I want to say is I've been on different trips to the Hill beyond the DC trip. And one of the things that we've cited as being a positive to the DC trip is it is self-organized, it's grassroots, that we don't bring lobbyists on those trips. So I've been on, you know, for example, the group which is supported of the national labs around what's it called? I forgot its name right now. It's a silly acronym, starts with 2 S's. It'll come back to me in a second. And that is completely run by lobbyists, where they bring scientists with them, and it's very managed. And one of the strong feedbacks that we've heard is that kind of managed trip where we bring professionals on it is one of the benefits we've seen about our trip is the fact that we don't run it in that way. So I think we should be careful and weigh up the decisions. You know, yes, 100%, we've talked for a long time about reaching out and having a community-wide database of all the people who are interested and what metrics that we can use to quantify everyone across our whole community to get involved in this. But it's not clear to me that professionals is the way to go.
Well, Well, so the thing is that actually one thing that I've seen from being in the field for 12 years is that there are people who are leaving the field who are interested in advocacy. And what would be really neat is if we could have dedicated roles where people are, are able. So in particular, so I know somebody who went from physics, a higher energy physics theory, and then went into the DOE, and then was actually looking for a position to do more advocacy and couldn't find one because it doesn't really exist. I do think that there would be some benefit to having someone who's in the field. You know, we have plenty of postdocs and graduate students who are interested in these things, and if we could have somebody who's physics PhD. But also interested in continuing advocacy could be a good way to have our resources. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone. Well, I do think that having a somewhat of a managed communication effort is, especially for a variety of things that we can go into it at another point, it can be useful. But if we just had an opportunity to say, okay, well, we have some people who are interested in physics, enjoy physics, and we can have them 50% time on this full year round.
That's an interesting point.
Can I just ask a clarifying question about that anecdote? This is someone who is seeking an opportunity in their free time to support the high energy physics community because they think it's important, or they're looking for a career, making part of their career to advocate for science?
They wanted it to be their career because they had left. They were really interested in theory. And also became interested in science advocacy, and then could not come back into doing something. And could not find a position to do this permanently within HEP. So now, I was trying to get in contact with her because I know that people at DOE really liked her, and she had some comments about this as well. But I don't know if there's a moratorium in discussing with the field.
But can you employ such a person on government money? That would be very difficult.
So my point is more that if we could find another way to obtain, a salary for these people, then they could do something like 50% postdoc if they're interested, which a lot of people still are, and then 50% time advocacy. And I do know, even from talking to graduate students, you see a lot of people who are leaving, who would like to spend more time on this.
Go ahead, Vetri.
I was just going to say, if I could comment just very quickly on the first thing that was said about reaching out to the broader community and just kind of how to do that. I guess in the past it's been done through the Fermilab UEC. I think everyone recognizes this, but like not everyone uses Fermilab. Like I personally don't use Fermilab, so like I'm not on any of those email list or anything, but I think that we didn't have an HEP email list until like a few months ago when the Snowmass process started, right? And like now we do, and now we have Slack and all of this infrastructure. If we just had like a well-timed email to like all of Snowmass with Young Keys approval or something, then maybe that would bear fruit. I don't know, maybe you've already done that and I am unaware, but that seems like an easy first step.
So I think it does come back at some point to how we fund the existing advocacy, aside from how we would fund expanding that in some infrastructural way. And I will revise my previous observation and comparison to the AAAS situation to say instead that yes, Fermilab elects members of the community to serve in this capacity, and one of their responsibilities becomes advocating for the field. But Fermilab itself hasn't been elected to be the representatives of the entire field. And so there's certainly a structural gap where it's clustered around the big labs and the US LHC Users Association. Which I think gets exactly to the point that you were just making.
Yeah. I don't think we're disagreeing, but I just wanted to bring that up. Because, like, you know, like, I work in, like, direct detection, for example. And, I mean, I work at LBL, so it's entirely possible that, like, I've gotten some communication through that and just missed it. But, we don't really work with Fermilab really at all, and we don't really work with the LHC users really at all. So there's definitely like gaps there.
Just on a logistical note, would one of the non-conveners be willing to jump in and help keep the minutes up to date? I think Louise had to step away from her computer.
I have to leave early, so I have a cutoff, sorry.
I can do it. Does the meeting end in half an hour?
Yes, we'll end at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, sounds good. Then I can do it.
Thanks. Okay, so let's see. Staying on this theme, does anyone have specific ideas? Okay, so one idea has been identified, which is to use the Snowmass infrastructure to help expand our reach into the community. And I think this is a great idea, and that infrastructure, as far as I'm aware, there wasn't really anything left from Snowmass 13 to latch onto, although maybe there was and we all just forgot about it. So perhaps the to-do is to make sure we don't forget about this infrastructure 2 years from now, because we have this access. And in my opinion, the Slack workspace goes a long way towards this if it is maintained. Do people have other thoughts?
You mean simply for communicating with the broader HEP community?
And facilitating the broader involvement in folding more groups of people into the advocacy efforts?
Well, to be, I think people need a wake-up call, to be completely frank. Look, I do think that the HEP advocacy efforts and the trips to Washington are working positively for the community. But I also think that, I mean, one thing we could try to work on the communication with the HEP community. You know, it's probably not so bad to just simply run numbers in terms of this is how much money we're being appropriated. This is how many physicists we have, and this is how many postdocs we have, and this is how many graduate students we have. And so giving people the reality that their budgets will be cut under certain scenarios, especially when you have something like no increase from Congress, while we do have increases in, for instance, university overhead costs, that, you know, or salary or anything from that to postdoc costs to whatever, then that we will be cutting people. And so maybe if we can find a way to bring this closer to home, it could be useful for the community as a whole. And I don't know, this group is very positive. I don't want to be, I do think some doom and gloom for the community could be a way to get them more involved, to be frank.
That seems like a fair point to me. I think one of the weaknesses we have as part of this effort is trying to analyze the data that's available, even at the level of just tracking the appropriations that the community receives. The only attempt I've seen to do that has come from Alan Stone, and it's just the high level, this is the budget line for HEP each year, and oh, it's going up, that's great, and that is good. But I think it's important to anchor that in relevant statistics, as you're saying, like how many people are in the community and what fraction of that is research and how does that impact the, you know, it's all well and good that we're successful in getting money to build Dune. Yes, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking it's, I don't know if people would be willing to do this, but we could ask for metrics like how many postdocs are in your group, how many, you know, how many faculty members and what's the cost at the university for X, Y, and Z, and then try to get an average. And then try to compare the year over year costs to, for instance, for the research budget or whatever, to how the budget is has been trending.
How much of that information could we ask the DOE for?
So you mean the budget projection? I mean, certainly the budgets for the last whatever number of years are readily available. And to be fair, we are with, so that number is readily available. So you're asking how much of the costs per university is available?
Well, rather than going around within the community and asking everyone, hey, how many postdocs do you employ? If we could ask the DOE how many postdocs all of their grants cumulatively support.
My understanding is that information from the DOE is quite private because then you have some issues with the with groups being favored and then they don't like to go there. I remember seeing surveys on things like this for other reasons within CMS, within the experiment, and I remember not being able to go to the DOE. But it could be that for the right reason, they might give you the information. You could also try to make the survey unanimous. Anonymous.
I wonder if...
Yes.
So it seems to me a flawed strategy to rely on individual PIs or even universities to be proactive enough to give us that information. Maybe the experimental level is more likely to succeed, where we go around to the experiments. But I guess that excludes, that categorically excludes some folks as well.
I mean, one thing that...
And we get underwhelming feedback.
Even if you have about 10 university groups who do it, you know, then that could give us some metrics, and you could provide like a range of options too. Does the postdoc cost X, Y, or Z at your university? And then there are also some caps in terms of how much, for instance, a faculty summer salary can be. I think it's something, yeah. So there's some cap as well. So you could use some guesstimate number. And then in the end, if you just give the community you give the community what the metrics were, then they can do their own quick mathematics to figure out what it was. But maybe the more interesting thing from a university point of view is to get the increase year by year. Because as you know, graduate student tuition is going up with undergraduate tuition. So that's actually becoming a big issue, in my opinion.
Which means the overhead for supporting a student on your grant is going up.
Exactly. And I don't know, and you know, just thinking aloud, I don't know if it's going up with I mean, definitely it's outpacing inflation. I don't know if it's going up with the current budget.
Or more importantly, the research fraction of the current budget.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Great, this is very interesting. So I will say that there is a standing request out to the early career, Snowmass early career group that's attached to the community engagement frontier, that if someone's looking for a project, that we have some ideas for how to slice up the data that's available from the DOE, just at the level of the budget, not drilling down into individual universities. And that's at least the step one on this train of thought.
But does it provide year over year changes at the university or trends?
So the standing ask that we've made is what doesn't involve any university level information. So it is not, it's going maybe, you know, 5% of the way towards the ideas that you've proposed. Let's see, I think I would like to give an opportunity to anyone who hasn't spoken to contribute any thoughts that they have on individual topics we've discussed or any related topics, anything to do with how we train the community to engage in advocacy and how we educate the community about the advocacy that we undertake.
I think one aspect which is very important and which is missing in US high energy physics, the two large component of in the US at present, looking from the Fermilab perspective, and high energy is not only Fermilab, so let's quantify it, qualify it, let's point. The neutrino community and the collider community, two places, which our neutrino community is really large. It is the, you know, Fermilab's main program right now with rare decays, rare physics studies, and collider at CERN. The synergy means the two groups, people from two groups, they are not very uniform in supporting each other. That message also goes to DOE. Okay, that kind of message from the community should not be going, because if there is an excellent project in high energy physics in any sub branch of high energy physics, let's put it that way, there should be uniform support from the community, the whole community. It looks like that the US high energy collider and neutrino community is fairly divided, which is not the best thing that can happen. So in this snow mass process, I certainly know Yankee will be doing her best, but this thing has to be brought into this kind of messages should not go, that one exists at the cost of other, but both of them could be mutually successful and beneficial for the community. Because one, if one shrinks, whether it is collider or neutrino, the other will get hurt too. And I'm very sure the same thing applies to dark matter and other searches, okay, of different kind.
So I certainly agree with the high level point that you're making, Brajesh. I do think it's appropriate to push back a little bit. So number one, speaking from experience, a critical element of the training that we do provide to members of the community who participate in the advocacy is exactly this, that folks should not be going into offices advocating for their specific work within the community over any other. And the critical, my understanding of the critical advance that the community has made in the last 10 years is that we can use P5 to say, look, the community has agreed on these priorities and this is the plan that we're following. Sure. And when you fund us, you're not just funding, you know, my pet project or my, you know, neutrino physics, you're funding the priorities of P5, and that the community uses Snowmass and then P5 on top of that to come up with the set of priorities.
Mm-hmm. Can I be completely honest about the P5 point, though? As I don't necessarily, I mean, it's a small panel of people. I don't necessarily think that everyone is in agreement within the community, throughout the communities, that this is what we want to do.
For example, I will believe that the European strategy of particle physics, that 12-page document, most of us have read it. In that, it goes about all the collider that we will do at CERN till 35, which is lovely because I do that. And then there will be a large collider. It doesn't mention much detail, but FCC-EE and FCC-PP, which is again very good for the future generation younger physicists. But you see that neutrino, it doesn't give that much emphasis. Whereas a very large community of Europeans is involved in Dune experiment. Right now, currently, both the spokesperson or one of the spokesperson is from Europe. This, when it started, both were from Europe. And it is a merger of LBNE and LBNO. And I have seen it growing from 2010 when I joined LBNE as the first US institution with five institutions. And then we were there. I was part of international, interim international executive board, which merged the LBNE and LBNO. But I find the same, problem in European approach also. Sure, CERN is the main lab of Europe, but then CERN should have been supporting the neutrino program a little bit more forcefully and dynamically and its own community rather than just relegate it to something, okay, it's really, really number two or less important, rather than saying that, yes, our thing is this one and we support our community very strongly. I do not know how else the community world has read it, but I believe that many senior people in US has taken it as, look, we will do this and yeah, we will also support something, which didn't give a very strong message to the US physicists who are doing neutrinos. So this is my personal perspective, but I may be reflecting the views of a lot of people. So the same thing should not be getting reflected, although last P5, if I agree, and I believe that it didn't write everything or everyone didn't agree, at least on few important topics, last P5, whose report I read line by line, was very emphatic on what they are going to do and the collider and the neutrinos and others. They were mentioned in fairly uniform detail, and when they brought out these three frontiers and all the relevant questions that were unanswered, which was shown by all of us in a lot of policy meetings and others and funding agency meetings all over the world, very uniformly, that these are the very important thing that Fermilab is going. And it set a tone for the global high energy physics in some sense. So yes, we have to do that, but in the P5 report, I find that there was a fairness. I agree with you, Rob. But in the community among the senior people, I still believe that there is a lot of I have to just live by my own project. And when I say project, they mean, broader neutrino, broader weak physics, broader collider physics, which encompasses all physics. Dark matter is still a small business and leave it out some approach. I think this has to go, especially from the younger generation. I'm sure you are doing it. You guys are doing a very good job, but this has to go out. Because otherwise we end up hurting our own community. And since I have worked in both neutrino and collider, I find it this little bit disconcerting, this approach among my colleagues who are of my age or a bit younger or older, with 30 years.
So let me try to repeat what I'm hearing from this feedback. Is that number one, and I'll say, as a disclaimer, that I, as a younger member of the community, the first time I participated in the advocacy was the first year that we had P5. So I have no idea what happened in the previous P5 report. So I want to acknowledge Isabel's feedback that maybe the P5 process is not perfect and doesn't completely reflect the... I can't speak to the process, and I'm not. It's unclear to me if trying to understand how, if and how the P5 process overall is flawed, if that's within the scope of this group or within the whole Snowmass process. Although this is something we should keep on our radar, and then to Brajesh's point that, even if we have P5 and the younger generation buys into it as a message of unity, maybe some more experienced folks in the community are not buying into it at the level of standing behind it in their personal interactions. Does that seem accurate?
Yep. I gave you an example of the European Strategy Report. I found it a little disconcerting that neutrino was mentioned. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, no, I wanted to give Mateus an opportunity. He's been trying to say something.
I'm sorry, apology. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, don't worry. Sorry, I put it on the chat. It's just that when we're talking about getting data, because I agree with Rob that asking people to fill a survey, we can't get people to do that when it's something super interesting, when I really don't think we're going to get meaningful data just asking people. But so we're looking to some data, especially when it comes to higher education for the early career survey. And this reference that I put on the chat came up, and let's call it, sorry, the full name, it's the Chronicles of Higher Education. And they have a lot of data that talks to this, that talks about like faculty salaries and also the cost of postdocs and how many people in areas, and specifically, so just that may be, yeah, what I'm saying is that it may be better to try to find data that already exists than to try to ask people for it.
So, the one thing I'll say is that the reason why would say the survey, did they have year over year changes in this report?
Well, this is a whole website that have specific reports and specific data and specific articles. So there are many things, including some year by year things, yeah.
I mean, so part of the reason for the for this survey is more to engage with the community as well, so we can get their information. That's all.
Thanks, Mateus and Isabel. I want to give an opportunity to we haven't heard from Kirsty or Garvita. If you all have any thoughts that you'd like to share. And if you don't, it's totally fine.
Mateus just said what I would have wanted to add about from survey point of view, that there's also on Chronicles and then on the AIP also has multiple studies on the faculty salaries. And so if somebody wants to go ahead and look at, so I linked it in the chat. And these two resources are actually really good if you want to look at previously collected data. Chronicles is more general data, so if we're looking more for high energy physics, it might be harder to find direct references in Chronicle. But in AIP, it has physics, like physics and astronomy related data that might be much more useful for us for what we're talking about.
Great, thank you.
I don't have a huge amount to add. I share the worries that people don't respond to surveys. I think getting this sort of data, it would be worthwhile asking the DOE. The labs might also have some information. I know the users office in Fermilab tracks the number of users. Although of course that doesn't get everyone. We have made claims in our DC trip materials about the number of scientists we represent. And you know, we're definitely ballparking, we're not going for very specific figures, but those claims must be based on something.
I can actually comment on that because I have, Louise has raised her hand. Go ahead,
Louise. Well, I mean, go ahead. I was gonna just comment where that came from, but you can go ahead.
I was just going to say that at some point in the past, I have been on an email thread with the user's office trying to update that number that we advertise and asking them how they count it up. And it's basically, they have a database of all the active users broken out by postdoc or grad student. And then we decided some way of counting that.
There is a more, so for the more recent version, which is on the DOE, the usparticlephysics.org, that's based on grants, so high energy physics grants that have been given out with PIs, postdocs, and graduate students, which is information that could be provided. I do think there is, again, a small issue that I think that it's easier to get that information from the DOE because we can clearly define it as high energy physics than it is from the NSF. So that there could there be some issue there, but we have got that information from the DOE in the past, and we can do to get a to a relatively accurate number. There are some issues about it doesn't count undergraduates and interns and various other things which are actively working in our field. But we have got relatively accurate numbers in the past.
But okay, I'm talking about you. So one thing I wanted to point out is that I browsed some of this, but maybe there's a lot more, but the number I don't usually see in these reports is the increasing cost year by year, not the increasing numbers of enrollment or what have you. And I know that's difficult to quantify, but it's something that I see at the, well, at the Fermilab level and at the university level, is that people just, every employing somebody is the cost of that is really increasing quite a lot. And I would hazard to guess it's increasing faster than the budget.
Yeah, I mean, we can definitely get that information, you know, from the DOE and definitely from Fermilab, because I've seen it real recently with the overheads, and they do comparative analysis. They just did it recently within Fermilab compared to the other national labs between the cost of people and the overhead that Fry did. But we'd need to make sure, but that's obviously just a very small set of people, and it's probably complicated to get some accurate representation of that from the universities. It's possibly best, you know, if we ask the DOE, they obviously provide some amount of money and overhead within their grants. We can try and work out exactly how they calculate that. I don't know, you know, still ask the question of do people think that the overhead and the costs that are being given within a grant reflects reality? But we could definitely try and collect some of that information.
Yeah, I mean, again, so my only point is that if the costs are growing faster than the budget, then this is an issue. And a lot of people don't have any say. They can put people off campus, for instance, to try to reduce the cost, but we don't really have any say in terms of what the costs are. It's university overhead, And then the other point is that a lot of times the budgets that we submit do not include pay increases for graduate students, so, or postdocs for that matter.
I mean, as per the, so in the AIP link that I shared for the statistics for faculty, so if you do look at the salaries for faculty in universities, in at least in physics, and similarly for postdocs, it does look like, if you look at the trends, it does look like with time they are adjusting for inflation. So I would argue that maybe there needs to be adjustment in the grants somehow. I don't know how they're doing it, but at least from the data, it seems like there is some adjustment at some level that allows the salaries to change with the inflation. So, and Ford, we had another meeting this morning, and another person who's looking into this mentioned that for faculty level, it's always been ahead, a little bit ahead of the inflation trends, at least within high energy physics. So I guess I'm not completely sure what the concern at the end boils down to here.
Postdocs.
For postdocs. Okay, for postdoc, at least from the AIP surveys, it looks like there's a large variation in the salaries for anyone who is in a postdoc position across the United States, because it starts from 40K and it goes up to, I think, 60 or 70K a year. And
I do want to wrap this conversation up.
Sorry. Okay. But I guess it's because at the level of postdoc, you still have, you can argue for your salary. So, and it's very much dependent on where you are doing your postdoc. So again, I don't know how I can add to this.
Yeah, just so in the end, the point that I'm hearing is that, so we see the salaries going up and being properly adapted to inflation, But if the grants are not following, it just means that these people are getting more expensive, right? And that may be the, I think that's the problem that Isabel was talking to. And it's hard to inquire.
Yeah, you know, having an accurate representation of whether or not the increase in costs are matching, for instance, what we are asking for. And I have to go to...
It sounds like we've identified an excellent topic to dig into deeper. I do want to wrap up the conversation and just emphasize that this is a first step in having the conversations in this broad topic. So please, if anyone has follow-up thoughts that come to them later this week or whenever, feel free to reach out or start a conversation on Slack. And we will be resuming conversations about this topic in particular at some point in the future. I'm not sure when specifically. And then we'll have a meeting on a different topic 2 weeks from today. So let's see.